Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of consciousness and also where we're going as a planetary civilization. And because of this awakening that's happening on the planet of who we really are as humanity, there's a great conference being scheduled this August, August 8th to the 11th, 2014, in Joshua Tree, called Contact in the Desert. And tonight's guest, Barbara Harris, is one of the keynote speakers there. But Barbara's also a local historian for the Joshua Tree area, and we'll be getting into the great history of kind of interdimensional UFO activity that has taken place in that part of the California desert for the last 30, 40, 50 years. Hi, Barbara. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yes. I did meet you last year at Contact in the Desert, but I didn't go on some of your tours, although I have been to Giant Rock out there in the desert. But why don't you give us a little background since Contact in the Desert, and also for people listening to this program, you can enter a contest where if you go to my website, newrealities.com, you could get a free ticket by filling out the application and entering a contest and join us in the desert. So anyway, out there in Palm Springs, Joshua Tree area, there's been a history of UFOs. Can you give us a little background about what you know of the area?
Oh, okay. This goes back way back. And, the desert itself, as most people know, it has a certain draw for spirituality over time. And this area in particular, the Mojave, has a very special draw, and especially the historian in me. Around the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, this particular part of the Mojave was such a draw for spirituality, ufology, and whatever. You came to this area to see that. The Joshua Tree Retreat Center, in particular, where this conference is being held, was where a man named Ding LeMay started the retreat center. It was known as Mental Physics, and he actually came out here from New York. And give you a little background about Ding LeMay. He was a man who mapped China, Tibet, and parts of Asia, and he merged Eastern theology with Western theology, came to New York, opened up a center called Mental Physics, brought it here to the desert in the 1930s and 40s, and well, 1940s out here, and opened up what was called Mental Physics. But that was just the start, because not only he brought that to this desert, but there was a man named George Van Tassel and other spiritual people of the area. And what draws them to this area is mostly the open desert, the aquifers, and the fact, too, that it's close to a 33rd parallel. It's an energy parallel line, a ley line that circulates around the Earth. So that's a little bit of why you would come to the desert for this particular conference.
So there's like an energy vortex in that area. Is that why you feel Ding LeMay, George Van Tassel were drawn there?
Yeah, that's a little bit why. This whole area consists of a big vortex, and most people would tell you it's because of the aquifers and the and of these ley lines. And to give you a little bit of a background, this area sits relatively close to the 33rd parallel. And for people who are into numerology, the number 33 is a very auspicious number to begin with, because if you go into biblical stories, the 33 is a number that King David ruled And number 33 is the number that, you know, how many years Christ was before he was crucified. You also look at the human biology. 33 is the number of the DNA strands of the human DNA. And to make it more interesting on how the 33 number plays into the energy field of the Earth energy, it also, this is where it really plays into this area the most, is because it, the 33rd parallel is where the most UFO sightings are on Earth. And it's where Roswell sits. It's where the Phoenix Lights happen. It sits where the Bermuda Triangle is, the Great Pyramid of Giza. It's also where Baghdad and Iraq are. And to also add to the synchronicities of it, it also is where Nagasaki, and Hiroshima are. So that if you go online, it's a number, and it's a ley line around the Earth that generates a lot of energy, and we just happen to be on and very near that same energy field. Interesting, huh?
I see. Well, that's why all the UFO activity. And can you talk a little bit about Giant Rock and the history and what Giant Rock is? Because that's a big part of it.
Giant Rock is a giant boulder. And I want to make it clear that it's different than the Ayers Rock in Australia, because this is a boulder that sits out in the middle of the desert. And you've got to imagine the terrain out here. And you got a boulder that's 7 stories tall, okay? So it's a big boulder, and it's over 25,000 tons, and it covers an area over 5,800 square feet. So if you're driving out into the middle of the desert, all it does is pop out in the middle of the desert. And so you wonder about the geology of the area, and it goes back to prehistoric times when most people will assume that this boulder just landed here via glaciers. Our history goes back to the geology, where it was mainly done via volcanic, and how the groundwater, again, bringing up the aquifers, and how the groundwater formed this boulder that just sits out there in the middle of the desert. So, and the other thing that makes this boulder really unique is because of the weight and the heaviness of this boulder and where it sits. It sits, and its weight sit again on this ley line, this 33rd, close to this 33rd parallel. So it puts a lot of pressure on the Earth and creates this magnificent vortex. So what I would like to extend to your listeners, that if I can take you on a journey, that you drive out to the middle of this desert. It's dark. It's middle of the night. You have these dark skies that are just twinkling with stars. And there's this big, fantastic boulder out there. And you can feel this vortex of energy that just resonates and just kind of resonates to the universe to call down and just, here I am, come get me, type of feeling. It's beautiful. It's fantastic.
You said the boulder was formed by the underwater. I mean, didn't it come from somewhere, the boulder? I mean, it looks so out of place. I've seen that. I've been out there. But it looks so odd, because there's nothing that big in that whole area like that.
Yeah. And actually, if people are acquainted with the Joshua Tree area itself, if they ever went to the national park, then that's what draws people to the Joshua Tree National Park, or a lot of our boulders. And that's what we're famous for, actually, is our boulders. But out where this boulder sits, it's in Landers, California. There is an area that extends outward to the north of this boulder, where there was a lot of volcanic activity at one time, at a prehistoric time. And according to how the geology of this area worked, that these volcanoes would erupt. And what would happen is the lava and the magma field would cover the area. and then the groundwater would come up, cool the area, and it would crack. And the boulders would then start forming from these cracks. And this would happen many times over time until these boulders would just be formed and just be sitting out in the middle of the desert. So it's a very long process, and I'm not really a geologist. And for those who are really interested, they can actually go to the Joshua Tree National Park website, and they would explain the process there for you.
But you're right. The weight of that boulder, in variance to the weight of the earth, creates some kind of, effect, geomagnetic or some kind of mass and energy. There's some kind of effect that even smaller boulders that would have called dolmens, where people would find there was a healing presence because of the relationship of the masses. The mass of the boulders to the earth would create some kind of field effect. Have you heard about that?
Oh, yeah. You're so right. Oh, you're so right with that. Because actually there are like geologists and mathematicians and people who have studied this. And they've gone out there and they've actually calculated the weight of that rock and the pressure that it puts on the earth in that particular area. And that rock is in line, and if you people have seen the ley lines and how they encircle the earth, and that particular rock is on the same ley line as the Great Pyramid of Giza. So when you stand out there, you're actually in Egypt if you want to connect your energy fields to the other side of the earth. And that pressure that is exerted onto that part of the earth creates its own vortex. And this is not, some people might say, oh, this can get all Fruit Loops and wind chimes on you, but it has actually been calculated and mathematically evaluated in that spot to actually prove that there is an energy fluctuation that happens in that area. It's amazing.
Right.
And people can feel it.
It's a chilling effect, but also talk a little bit about the history. I mean, George von Tass, but talk also how there were lots of people that would go out there in the 50s and then the prediction about the rock, about its cracking. Can you give me a whole rundown? Because, I mean, I've only heard bits and pieces, and you're the historian, so I'm sure you know the whole thing about the gatherings there in the 50s and then what happened later. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Oh, this is what's so exciting, because every time I think I've just got part of the history of giant rock, there's always another part that comes through. But as I explained, giant rock not only has a prehistoric, but it started to go to the Native Americans, and the Native Americans had their history at giant rock where they would conduct their ceremonies. And then it evolved into the 30s where the miners and prospectors came to Giant Rock. They had their history there. And then after that, there was a man named George Van Tassel, and he's the most noted for Giant Rock. And what happened to George Van Tassel at Giant Rock is he had contact. He had visions, and he was known as the first space channeler. And what happened to him is he had contact with people from Venus. So he claims, and these people from Venus, they would tell him that, you humans, you've come along okay as a species. However, it seems like when you get to the age where you finally get it, you finally understand what's going on, you die. So what they did is they wanted to give George Van Tassel some instructions and some blueprints, you might say, on how to build a rejuvenation machine or a time machine, which he called the Integratron. And what George Van Tassel did from that point then is, in order to fund his Integratron, he created a ministry called the Ministry of Universal Wisdom, and he would put out a newsletter that would help fund this, the building of the Integratron, and he would also conduct UFO conferences. They called them interplanetary spaceship conventions. And they would be out there in the middle of this desert. And it would be where there was a time in the 50s and 60s where as many as 10,000 people would show up in the middle of this desert to listen to George Van Tassel and many contactees, as they called them, come out and talk about their experiences with UFOs. So
10,000 people, you said, would show up out at Giant Rock?
Yes. 10,000 people have been documented during the late 50s, early 60s. And that was,
wow.
And you got to imagine, that's during a time when there was no real air conditioning, no porta potties, and no, you know, there was no creature comforts that we know. And there would be people that have to travel from the big cities, we call them big cities, called like L.A., and they would travel out to the middle of this desert on dirt roads, and they traveled for miles to come to this big boulder and sit there and listen to conferences in the desert. And what's really unique now is this all happened in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And now, here we are in 2014, and guess what we're doing now in the desert? We're doing conferences again, and we're doing it at the Joshua Tree Retreat Center. So it's so exciting for me to see this coming full circle and having the history repeat itself.
Yes, I mean, it's only about 30 minutes, Giant Rock, from the Joshua Tree Retreat Center, isn't it? I drove there last year.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and people, you actually, when you take the tour, I call it a tour, but we're actually caravanning. We like to, you know, take everybody and, you know, get in the cars, and we combine everybody, and we're going to be going out to Giant Rock. We leave at about 7 p.m. in the evening after the sun goes down. Well, the sun's starting to go down, and we get out there, and once we get out there, we cruise around the area, and I go over the history, and I show you some things like where the Giant Rock Airport used to be, because there used to be an airport that people used to fly their planes in at to come to these conferences. And you also, there was also a pad out there where there was a restaurant called the Come On In that Howard Hughes used to fly in to come and get a hamburger or a piece of apple pie. George Van Tassel's wife used to make this spiced apple pie that people used to fly in to the airport out in the middle of this desert just to get a piece of this apple pie. And so
wow.
That's part of the history of this giant rock out in the middle of the desert.
Was George Adamski part of that crowd? Because he was kind of the most popular contactee of the 1950s. Did he know George Van Tassel?
Oh, yes.
George Adamski.
In fact, what's really fascinating for me, and I talk about the energy of this desert, is mm-hmm. George Adamski was one of the first people to speak at Van Tassel's Interplanetary Spacecraft Conventions, is what they were called. And also, the George Adamski, he had his sighting, also one of his famous sightings, just about an hour. I'm going to say it's an hour down the road from the Joshua Tree Retreat Center. So it is called a place down here. It was actually now part of the Joshua Tree National Park, his actual area where he had the sighting, but it's close to an area called Desert Center. So, again, talking about UFO sightings, this is also where George Adamski had his sighting up here, and it's all within an hour of everybody's sightings, and people actually go to the national park, even nowadays, they'll go to the national park just to pitch tents and to look for sightings. And it's just a very popular spot to go UFO sightings.
Well, we're going to have the people who developed the night vision glasses. Do you know about them? They're going to be, do you know the night vision glasses? They're sort of infrared glasses, so a lot of people see ships in the night that you cannot see with the naked eye through these glasses. So Ed Grimsley, who developed them, and this guy Nick Ellis, who also has his own set, are going to be at the retreat center at the conference having people look through these night vision glasses.
Oh, please. Oh, yes. You need to have those, especially if you are going to come with us out at Giant Rock. That would be really welcomed because, you know, just to have that to distinguish between, you know, a satellite, a star, and to have night vision glasses out there is very helpful. I would really highly recommend them. Yes.
Well, I will tell one of the people coming that I've connected, you know, Victoria, people running the conference with, who's coming, this guy Nick, he's going to bring in. Maybe we'll go. I'll tell him to go out with you on one of your tours and show people what's out there. But
yeah.
So those conferences with George Santasso and George Adamski happened in the 50s and 60s, and then it sort of died out, the kind of UFO scene out there, but there were still people doing ceremonies and fires under the rock. And wasn't there a sort of prediction? Can you talk about that happened with the rock?
Yes. Well, you know, like I said earlier, the 50s and 60s, they were really a hotbed of sightings out here. And they were so popular at the time that even the locals, they actually published newsletters and published it in newspapers, their sightings. Now jump forward to 2000, the year 2000, and this boulder was a full-on boulder at the time. And there was a, in February 23rd in the year 2000, the boulder split. And you'll read in many of the things on the internet that this was a Hopi prophecy, that if the boulder split down the middle, that it meant that mankind was doomed to, you know, disintegrate and we were going to destroy ourselves. However, if the boulder split to either side, that as a species, we were meant to continue on and evolve as a species. However, as a historian, and for what I do, I have to look at all the facts in how I document and how I put down my information. And one of the things that I bring to the teachings is that the Hopi people were not a primary were not primarily native to this area. So that particular, you know, prophecy, it doesn't seem real relative for that rock at that time. However, many people can follow that teaching, and I don't, you know, what people want to follow and what they will believe, it will work for that particular teaching. However, when you look at photographs of how the rock split and why it might have split, I observe a scientific reason. And when I look at old photos of how George Van Tassel had his speaker stand attached to the rock, and the way the rock had the bolt, the nails or whatever they used attached into the rock, it created a stress factor at that particular spot. And according to other people that were out there at the rock when it split, it might have been because of the cold temperatures, an earthquake the night before. Somebody could have lit, you know, explosives under the rock. So there's a lot of variations of why this could have happened. However,
well, it does look like there were fires that people would make. When I was out there, it looked like people would make fires under the rock, and now I'm sure that created a stress between the cold desert air and the warm hot fires underneath there. I mean,
however, can I share something interesting with you? Because for me, I always look at time and how the world is and how it evolves. And this rock is millions of years old, millions. So no matter what happens, how it happens, I always look and I ask people the question, no matter how it happened, why did it still pick the day, February 21st, 23rd, the year 2000, to split? So it doesn't matter how it happened. It's just that particular day and the energy that happened that particular day, why did it pick that day to do it? So it still has a mystique about it that it leaves me with questions still unanswered.
Well, have you done the astrology for that day? Why do you think it was that day? February 23rd, 2000, huh?
Yeah.
What
it,
do you
it was
think?
Actually
why
the 22nd. The 22nd into the 23rd, because it happened late during the night or the morning.
And you said you knew people who were there? How did they? Because that's a huge slice of the rock that just, what did they say about the people who witnessed that?
Yeah, there were people out there camping, and it was actually kind of a local, because it was in the newspaper the following day, and can you imagine, this is a granite, solid granite rock, and when it split off and laid there on the ground, the local joke for a while was, gosh, I'd sure hate to be camping under that part of the rock, because people go out there to camp. You know, oh, tough you. We still don't know if there are people under there. But the thing that really made an awe sound with me and just brought me to my knees was when that piece of granite broke off and it sat there, it was so brilliant white. It was so beautiful and so gorgeous that it looked like that when the rock split off, it looked like it had released all this information. It had released like doves into the sky, into the universe. It was that first newborn baby, you might say, was opened, and it was just beautiful. So, since over this period of time, of course, you know, there's been vandals out there, and we have a history of having graffiti and things that do happen out at the rock. But I always take people out there and ask them to see past the outside skin and to see past that and to feel and to go into the energy of what's inside that rock, because it definitely has a nurturing, loving nature. So again, you know, to answer your question, did I ever do the numerology or the astrology of that period? And I'm sorry, I never did, and I haven't thought of that. So if anybody's out there and can do that, I'd be interested in knowing what that day in particular meant.
Yeah, or maybe charting that day for the area or whatever. But did you see it right after it split, or how much later did you come along and was there after that?
I saw it 17 days after it happened. I didn't live here at the time. I lived on the coast. I lived closer to the LA area at the time, and I did not know at the time that the rock had split. But my husband and I, We took these constant trips out here to the desert. It was a 2.5 hour drive for us to visit, and we made very common, you know, weekends. We would pick up and say, "Hey, let's drive out and see the rock and visit the Integratron." And that weekend, we drove out here, and I had no idea that the rock had split. But I got to tell you that on the road, we were driving our way out to the rock, and it was a big highway, and as we were driving to the rock, I kept telling my husband that I felt that the energy of the desert had changed, that there was something different, and I kept telling him that I kept feeling something different, And I would look down certain areas, and to me that I would look at the mountains, and the mountains looked different. The sky was looking different. Things were looking different. This was in a February time period. And it was really strange because when we pulled up to the rock ourselves, we had no idea this rock had split. And when we got out there, there were actually five other people that were standing there, and everybody was standing there in silence and just staring at the rock. And it was like this feeling of being stunned, and it was something that was so beautiful. And my first inclination was to walk up to the broken part that split off and to lean my body against this rock that had just opened up. And as I did that, I just burst into tears because I just felt, in my instincts and my first feelings were, is I felt that this rock, who I had had a connection with for years, I had been coming out there for years, and the information or the feeling that this rock, I called her my she, it's a mother, had just told me that by splitting off, she had just released into the universe all this information that she had been storing up for millions of years. And now it was time for humanity to receive this information that she had been holding on to. So for me, I felt that it was a time period, that February 23rd, 2000, was a time for this rock to gift humanity with her information, or what knowledge this rock had accumulated over the millions of years that it had existed. So, that was my personal experience.
Thank you for sharing that. That is a really cosmic story, and I think you are tuned into that. I mean, that's why I guess you're living out there now. I did go out to see the rock in 1985. I think that was the first time. It was actually at the Mental Physics Institute, when it was called the Mental Physics Institute, for a workshop, and I think I saw the rock then. And then it was a totally different energy when I came back to see it. I think the first time I saw it after that was in 2008, and it felt like a whole different energy to the desert, or to that part of the desert anyway, from 1985 to 2008. So,
it's definitely, I think we're on a verge now of evolving again. I monitor, again, as a historian, I monitor the history of the Earth and how humans evolve. And one of the things that I noticed that during the times of the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, there was a lot of ET activity, a lot of UFO sightings, but there was also a lot of turmoil in the world. There was, we were dealing with the nuclear bomb. We had World War II going. We had a lot of upheaval in humanity during those particular times. You figure the, 1960s, and humanity was making a lot of changes during that time. And then there was a period of time where it maybe out here in the 1970s, and when I look at our historian files, they kind of stopped. And I was kind of confused by that for a long time. But it took up until the year 2000, you might say, for it to start up again. And now here we are in the year 2014, and again, you look at what's going on in the world and how the world is acting and what's happening, and you also look at how the ET sightings and UFO sightings are becoming more commonplace. And humanity in general is looking to, they accept it more now. I think people are reaching out, and it's time for it. And I think
they're expecting 1,000 people at the conference coming up August 8th to the 11th, Joshua Tree Retreat Center. You go to my website if you're listening, and newrealities.com. You can find out how to get a ticket to the conference. It'll be an amazing conference. But I think you're right. I think there is a resurgence of that interest because I think with the internet, the planet is becoming smaller. We are definitely becoming more integrated as a species, as a single human race. Of course, there's still the conflicts and the problems and the pollution and the, but you know, I think we can see the possibility of uniting as a planet. And I think that's a positive sign for who's ever visiting that maybe, you know, there's actually some evolved people here that, that can deal with visitors. That's how I see it.
Yes, I agree. And I think that's why I think more now than ever, I think we're ready for contact. I think more than ever that E.T. can just walk into a conference like this and be accepted. And, you know, the Joshua Tree Retreat Center, it's a perfect spot for something like this, not only because of where it's situated here in the desert. You know, it's, you know, 400 acres, and it has, you know, 18 vortexes of its own. It's labyrinths, medicine wheels. And the energy itself has been there for eons. And, you know, I talked about the aquifers, the waters that run underneath it already. So people who come just to the property itself can get their own recharge of the desert there. And on top of these fabulous speakers that we're going to have, you know, Eric Van Doniken, you have Giorgio Tsoukalos, you know, George Norrie, and I mean, you just add that all to the mix.
Oh, yes. The best, I would say the most professional researchers in the field on ufology, which is a very serious subject. I mean, of course, it's not taken seriously by most people who aren't in it, but it's the people who are involved know that people like Linda Moulton Howe and Richard Dolan, who are some of my favorites, they have really done their homework. It's not like, oh, there's a UFO. I mean, these people have been studying this for years, and government involvement, government cover-ups. I mean, it's huge, the field. And this is the place where I would say the people around the country and around the world will come together to discuss these major issues that affect the planet. This is the place.
I think this time we're going to really explore these ancient aliens, ancient astronauts. We're really going to be getting into human origins this time, you know, crop circles. I mean, this is in-depth studying here. And it's not only going to be all head stuff, because I like to tell people, even if you're the drag-along, somebody who's just coming along because their mate or their friends have an interest in it and you don't, you come along because you're going to want to experience this desert, just the feel of being here in the desert and what that's going to do to you, the rejuvenation of just being here. And also what people don't know, that during this particular time is what we have known as the Perseid meteor showers. You were here last year for those, weren't you? Did you see them?
Yes, I didn't see as many meteors as I would like, but I did see some. Did you see a lot of meteors?
Well, see, that's why you need to come out to Giant Rock, out to that big open area out there. And we got to see those pink and green and orange meteors shooting all over the place out there. And they're beautiful. And that's one of the things we celebrate out here in the August summers, you might say.
Well, so you living there full-time, what? Like, did you just love the desert so much that you just wanted to be there all the time? Or why did you go there?
Oh, well, I'm originally from Pennsylvania. So I grew up with grass, rolling green hills, and beautiful trees, and beautiful fall. And I came to California after I graduated from an art school, and moved out here and started a business and met my husband-to-be. And he lived here in California, and he would tell me, you know, I'm going to take you out to the desert. And for dates, we would come out here and throw sleeping bags in the car and go hiking and go roaming around the desert. Now, I never thought I would be a desert rat because people say there's no trees, there's nothing out here. So it's got to be where you either love the desert or you hate the desert because, like I said, there are no trees. It's pretty sparse. However, I became hooked. I loved it. And I'm married 33 years now. And prior to that, this is where we came. We came out here to the desert, and eventually we got married. We started a business on the coast. And 10 years ago, we decided that we got tired of sitting on the freeways in the LA area. We got tired of doing all that. And I wanted to extend my research of Giant Rock and this area and the ufology in the area. So we bought a house out here in the Joshua Tree area. It's called Yucca Valley. And we moved out here. And it's become a passion. It's really, I tell people, it's really become a, on Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when Richard Dreyfuss is sitting there building the Devil's Tower in the Mashed Potatoes. That's kind of how it is for me with the giant rock and the boulder. It's such a passion for me.
Do you go out there a lot?
Oh yeah, a lot. Quite a bit. It's not far from where I live, and most of my people who know me often say, oh, if you can't find Barb, she's out roaming the desert. You can always find her out there, out of Giant Rock. And I'm very closely associated with the Morongo Basin Historical Society. I've been president
of the Historical Society.
The Morongo Basin Historical Society. And I was the president for a while, and that's where I continued to do a lot of my research and was able to actually talk to the locals and understand through them what actually happened at Giant Rock and got their firsthand views, because many of the locals still live from that time period. So I got firsthand experience and firsthand accounts of their experiences from their, experiences at Giant Rock, many of them seeing their own sightings at Giant Rock.
Can you tell me about some of the experiences that people have had out there that you've talked to?
Oh, there's one sighting in particular that there was a San Bernardino policeman, and there's a picture of people who are at this spaceship convention, and while they were at this spaceship convention, there was actually a ship that was marked up in the sky, and they took pictures of it. It's a very well-known documented photograph, and what happened is this San Bernardino police officer, he took a picture, and he made a big thing of it, saying that he was a non-believer, and he would come to these conventions, to oversee the conventions. And he shows a picture of what he took of Giant Rock prior to the spaceship appearing, and then after the spaceship appeared, and it shows people running and talking to some of them. I call them the old timers. They talk about how that experience that particular day, how it changed their lives, and.
Well,
what
year
happened.
Was that? Do you know what year that San Bernardino
Hold on a second. Let me check this. I think it was 1959, but I think it was in particular 1959. I'm almost sure. Yeah, it was May 15th, 1959, and it's well documented.
A single ship? Was it a huge sighting of a single ship there?
Well, when you look at it, it almost looks like a cloud, like a residue that was left over. But the people that actually had it documented, they did all kinds of studies on it, and there's some websites and some different things about it where they did it, like polarization of it. They did the energy vortex around it. They analyzed the whole ship. They analyzed this whole photograph to show that it wasn't a made-up photograph, that it wasn't something, you know. And you got to imagine, you know, this was before we had... Yeah, Photoshop and all the technology and all the stuff that happened. So, you know, it was basically people who were trying to dismantle and say, this is a real photograph, this is something that happened, and they went into detail with it. It's really a very interesting, that, you know, and that's only one of many, many stories that, as a researcher and part of, you know, of a historical society that I've been, you know, fortunate to talk to and to get people's stories about. So it's fun stuff for me. It really is.
Well, the other thing I want to just talk to you about, because you kind of just mentioned it briefly, is George von Tassel, Integratron, and how he got messages to build this special rejuvenating building, which is not far, but what, a mile or two from Giant Rock, there's this structure. Well, you described it. That doesn't have any metal in it. That's what I've heard about. Talk about the Integratron.
Well, the Integratron is owned. Well, it was built by George von Tassel. He never had a chance to complete it. He died in 1978, so his dream was never fulfilled. It was built as a time machine, rejuvenation machine, and it was built with all wood, and it was built in a tug and groove type of way, where it was like shipbuilders. An interesting side note to it, that it was one of the contributors to the Integratron was Howard Hughes. And as we all know, Howard Hughes was also the builder of the Spruce Goose. So it's an interesting little side note with
that. He was the builder of the what? The what?
The Spruce Goose. Have you heard of the Spruce Goose? It's a big ship that was out here on the West Coast. That it wasn't a ship. It was an airplane, all built of wood, and it flew. Out here, it's now in Seattle, so people can look that up.
It was an airplane that didn't have metal in it? Is that what
yeah.
the one was?
Well, you know, it had metal because it flew, but people can look it up. It has a connection with Howard Hughes, and Howard Hughes was one of the first contributors to the Integratron, and this journey for the Integratron was... Howard was von Tassel. It was 18 years of his life. It consumed his life. He supported it through donations, through his Ministry of Universal Wisdom and other donations. And it has it resembled the Tabernacle of Moses, and it worked on a theory of positive and negative energy. So it would rotate. It was supposed to rotate. They had these, it's hard to describe when I can't show pictures, but these metal rods that extend from the middle of the white dome, and they were called die rods. And these die rods rotated on a bed of air. And as they rotated a fast pace of speed, it would create a magnetic, electromagnetic static arc. And it was kind of like a piece of lightning. And that lightning arc would then arc into the upper part of the dome and go. It gets real technical. It's based a lot on Tesla theories. And through this magnetic arc and these magnetics that the dome would create, it created a healing modality, you might say. And there were two doors on the bottom. There's two doors on the bottom that how it was intended that people would walk through one door and walk through the other door. And as this electromagnetic field was created, it would create healing in the human body. Now, this was so far ahead of its time because you've got to consider the 40s and 50s. And the thing is that we know nowadays that magnetics do heal the human body, but this was all relatively new in that period of time. So Van Tassel was on to something at that time. And so that's what makes it fantastic.
And, well, I've been in there. I had a good meditation there, but I didn't really feel, I have to say, to be honest, I didn't really feel anything that special. How was your feeling about being in the Integratron? Did it do anything for you?
The Integratron is used today as they use what is known as a sound bath. And what happens is when you go to the upper levels of the Integratron, because of the way it's made and the dome, it reflects sound. And without getting too technical or, you know, and that's not really my field of expertise, but as we all know today, sound also has healing modalities. And the Integratron is presently owned by three sisters, and they do these things with crystal sound bowls. They're called sound baths. And the way the sound then reflects on this upper part of the dome, it creates for many people a healing modality for them, and it's very effective for a lot of people. So I advise people to go to the integratron.com and they can find out more information, more than, you know, I can offer or, you know, give at this time with that. And,
but did you, have you felt anything particular there yourself energetically?
For me, I have been to the Integratron quite often, and I have had many experiences there. So I can speak from a personal standpoint of when I go into the Integratron, there's been times I've been fortunate enough to know the owners, so there. I'm just going to share one particular experience I had for me, and I was fortunate enough to be there in a summer setting, and I was in the downstairs area, and there's couches in there, and they have some books that you read, and I happened to lay down on the couch, and I kind of dozed off. And as I dozed off, I didn't know that I was really in a dream state. But I kind of woke up while I was dreaming. And while I was waking up and looked around, I actually felt that there were like two men sitting in these other chairs next to me. And when I came to a conscious, state of who these two men were, you know, one of them I happen to recognize from the photographs as being, you know, George Van Tassel. So, you know, I kind of felt that for me, this is my personal experience, I kind of felt that the energy of Van Tassel was still, you know, in his Integratron, still there guiding whatever was going on. And then the other man was a man that I had recognized who was very connected to the Integratron and was offering some information to me at the time. But to answer your question, I I do feel something when I go to the Integratron. For me, and I'm going to give you my theory behind it for me and what it has created for me. When I go upstairs and I participate in the sound baths and stuff, it creates a relaxing setting for me. And the sounds of the crystal bowls, because I'm a really hyper and stressed out person, that when I have an opportunity to just lay down and relax for a few minutes, and the sound of those particular bowls then seem to resonate with my particular energy fields. So as my energy fields get activated, it will put me in a state of like an alpha state. So I end up feeling like I've had, you know, 8 hours sleep in a 20-minute period. But that's my experience. Mm-hmm. And for many people who go there, each person has a different experience. And it's not fair of me to say what you might experience, or, and I don't like to delude what your experience might be, because by telling people what they're going to experience, you know, it kind of sets them up to say, oh, this is what you're going to experience. So you kind of like to leave it open so people get to experience what they experience. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? You know?
Yeah, of course. I was just curious of your experience, but I will go back. Maybe I'll go back with you or this
Have you been there recently?
No, I was there with J.J. Hertog a few years ago. J.J. Hertog, you've been George Montasso, and he was part of helping to create that in a way. So he brought a group there, and I was part of that meditation. But I don't know. Uh-huh. I didn't feel anything. I haven't been there recently. It's been a few years, but maybe I'll go back this summer.
Yeah. How many... a lot of it for me, I like I said, I've had the opportunity to experience it more on an alone time and a one-on-one time, and sometimes I would recommend that, to have more of a personal time. Going in group experiences, again, you're experiencing it with a group, and it does affect what you will feel. So leaving yourself open to that experience and having that one-on-one time in the upper dome is different. Now, for me...
Oh, is that possible? Can I have that? Would I be allowed mm-hmm. that one-on-one time?
Yes, yeah. They do take personal... They do have one-on-one time, and that's where you can go to theintegratron.com and book a private setting if you'd like. So, but for me, more, you know, the Integratron does one particular healing modality, but I have the same type of healing modality and the love of just hopping in my particular vehicle and driving to the open desert and the openness of the desert and experiencing that the boulder and the night skies, or there's an area also by Giant Rock called Crystal Hill. Now, that has a very interesting history, because supposedly it is where Van Tassel had a lot of his connections or channelings. And going back to the geology of the area, that when you go to the top of this Crystal Hill, it is totally made of white quartz crystal. And when you go there, it is nothing like any of the other geology in the area. And when we take people to this area and we come to the top of the area, they become so in tune with the environment, and they come into meditations, or they just feel things so in tune. And it's one of the most beautiful spots also to check out the sunsets and to be there in the night and watch the night skies. But again, I don't recommend people go there on their own. I would like to see people, you know, at least have a guide or somebody show them that. It's so different. It's a different part of that particular desert. But again, there's something very unusual to each part of these deserts, and it's all of them combined that makes it so super special. And as the energy connects, it kind of connects to form just this magnification. And for me, I feel that the Joshua Tree Retreat Center is that center. And that's where we're all going to be gathering.
It's going to be a lot of fun. There's that center. Of course, there's the UFO conference for 3 days. There's the giant rock. There's the Integratron. There's meditation. Stephen Greer is going to do his calling in the ships meditation. And James Gilliland. There'll be these night vision glasses. Of course, there'll be the most amazing UFO experts in the world there. And Eric von Daniken, who started the whole thing about ancient astronauts. Eric von Daniken was a trailblazer as he came up with this theory that the ancient gods were really from someplace else, you know, another planet. They were higher, more evolved beings. But you're going to be there leading tours. Tell us the dates and how to get in touch with you about your tours out to Giant Rock.
Well, they can go directly to the website at contactinthedesert.com, and then just look up my picture there. And I'm doing a speaking. I'm speaking also about Giant Rock on Saturday. And next to my little speaking information, you'll see tours. So you can click on that. And there's a slight charge for going out there. So, and then book your tickets. Because I do limit the amount of people that will be going, so this is a very limited group. We're not taking
how many people do you take? How many people do you take at a time?
I would prefer to have less than 20. So So when you have 1,000 people and only 20 people per night, however, I might be adjusting it per night depending on how the evenings do go, but. They're not going to be large groups. It's going to be a very personalized experience. People are going to enjoy it, and the people that do go out there, it becomes just something that they do remember. And you come out with
No, are you going out? The conference is Friday. August 8th to Saturday the 9th to Sunday the 10th, and for some workshops on the 11th. But are you going to be going out 3 nights, the 8th, 9th, and 10th, to Giant Rock with people?
Yes. Yes, we are. And
so you're doing three-night tours at least.
Yes. Yes, we are. And if you're coming in early on that Thursday, we also are doing some on that Thursday night.
Oh, you are? I'll be there on that early on Thursday. Maybe I'll go out there with you.
Okay.
But do you do private sessions if people called you up and you wanted to do this a small tour with a bunch of people? Is that something you do also?
Sure do, yes. Yeah. And and we have, you can catch me up through giantrockproject.com. And that's a work in progress, but you can contact me through that particular website, and we make arrangements for how many people, when you want to go, how you want to go. I've taken people out in the evenings where we've done, because it's, you know, BLM land, we're able to make little campfires out there at times. And depending on what time of the year it is, you know, having lunches or doing different things out there, we customize to what the group might want or need. So,
well,
I
just want to say, you've mentioned Howard Hughes. I wanted to say, when I was in Spain, there was rumors that Howard Hughes was connected to a
landscape vortex in the city of Girona, or Gerona, north of Barcelona, and that Howard Hughes was investigating the portal, the energy spot there, and that was also related to Rennes Chateau in France. But now you're saying, you mentioned that he was also interested in the integratron. I wonder, you know, that he was probably researching vortex connections or energy centers that probably a lot of people didn't understand about him, that he probably kept quiet, but he was probably onto something with that. Did you hear anything else about his interest in energy? Or
no. Gosh, I would really like to know more about that, because actually up until last year, I really didn't put even the connection together with the spruce goose and the other things, but I knew he was very connected with George Van Tassel and the amount of, you know, interest he had with the integratron. So, I would like to hear about his connection.
Well, I'll tell you, I went to Spain with a woman named Patrice Chaplin, who did a vortex tour of northern Spain and southern France, and she heard talk among the locals there, someone called the Americano, who was this rich American who would come and be in on some of those tours of those vortexes back in the 40s and in that time, 40s and maybe 50s, and she thinks that was Howard Hughes. And, you know, there's this whole thing about a tower in that area of Spain that was connected to a tower in France. It's all in this book called The Portal by Patrice Chaplin.
Oh, okay. And, I'm going to have to check it. Check it out.
Yeah, it's a very interesting book. And Patrice is a very interesting woman. She was married to Charlie Chaplin's son, Michael Chaplin. And, she's a very interesting woman, intuitive herself. And so she lived for a long time in the Barcelona area in Girona, which is the Catalan area, and the Catalans have their own interesting mystical tradition. Anyway, Howard Hughes was somehow connected to the portals in that area, and it's interesting that he's also part of this kind of California, you know, energy scene with George Van Tassel. So he may have been onto something that a lot of people might not have understood about Howard Hughes.
Yes.
So that's my theory. Anyway, I know that's separate from the conference, but, you know, this is one other thing about the Joshua Tree Retreat Center. Wasn't some of the architecture built by Frank Lloyd Wright? Is that true?
The Joshua Tree Retreat Center, part of the architecture there was built by Frank Lloyd Wright and his son. And it's really fascinating, because some of the different rooms that you go into, everything's built in triangles. And what I find cute and fascinating is there's some of the showers are actually triangles. And and of course, when throughout the property, you can see triangles everywhere. And again, remember I mentioned the number 33. But again, it brings on to that number three, the three and the power and the energy and what the three does, you know, the Trinity again, and what the all throughout the property you're going to see triangles everywhere, and how they relate with the energy and how energy flows. So it's,
I think that was part of Dingell May's design, was the triangle, because he was quite a mystic. Dingell May, the founder of the Joshua Tree Mental Physics Institute there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his influence was to put some of those triangles around because of the, you know, trinity of the earth, humans, and the heavens. That's part of the basic trinity of creation. Actually,
yeah.
When I was there, it was called the Mental Physics Institute, and they They said, I mean, this is a side note, but they said it was in Yucca Valley. Did they change the zoning from Yucca Valley to Joshua Tree after they changed the name of it or something? Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, well, it was originally Yucca Valley when he moved it there, but then the zoning was changed to Joshua Tree. So
I was there in 19, I was there with the Rampa School in 83, 84. He did ceremonies in the desert. He had great, you know, fires in the day. It was beautiful to see out there in the middle of the night in the desert under the stars. And
I love it. I really just, see, that's what really has drawn me here. Again, you know, I look throughout history and through time, and, you know, people come to the desert for these cleansings and these things that are out here. And, you know, I always look at, you know, different religions and how they focus on the desert. And what I tell people, when you come here, you either are going to love it or you're going to hate it. However, the desert, this is my story to them, the desert will seduce you. You come here with an open mind, and she will, you know, you'll come here at a certain time, and it's so beautiful. The sunsets, the skies, and the breezes. So people will fall in love with the desert, and they'll make the choice to uproot their lives and move here. However, if you don't come here with an idea that you can be flexible, you need to learn to be extremely flexible in the desert, because if you don't, the desert's going to snap you, because the desert lives on extremes. We are very hot, and what people don't know about this part of the desert, it gets very cold. And it gets, we have snow up here. And the winds are incredible. So if you're not like a tree and you don't learn to bend and move with the elements, that you will snap and you will literally go crazy. And one example I share with people, and it's funny but it's not, that you'll see a lot of what out here, these little homestead cabins. Because, again, in the 1940s, the government offered 5 acres free to people who can come out here, build a cabin on 5 acres of land, and they told them they wanted them to farm the land. Now, the problem is how do you farm in the desert with no water? So a lot of the people that moved here didn't realize they couldn't do that. So they immediately left. And the people that did move here, what happened is a lot of them eventually went crazy. And in some of the stories that are told, there was this old lady in her cabins in the middle of the desert out there nowhere. And after a really brutal winter, because the winters do stay very cold and you don't get heat in a lot of them, and they went into her cabin after this brutal, windy, cold winter, and she was dead. And there was a suicide note by her side, and all it said, it was the wind. So the wind literally drove her crazy enough to commit suicide. So, and the papers, as a historian, the papers are filled with old people and people that had difficulty where the elements of the desert just drove them to the point of just suicide, because it just becomes too much at some point. So you either love it
or you hate very it. Interesting. Thank you for sharing that.
Yes, but I'm hoping you all show up at Contact in the Desert and be part of our fabulous Seconds conference and come out and take the tour. And see our speakers and be part of this fabulous event out here and enjoy it.
No, thank you so much, Barbara, for taking the time and introducing us to the desert. This is going to be a 3-4 day event in Joshua Tree at the Joshua Tree Retreat Center. You can go to newrealities.com to get the details. You can go to contactinthedesert.com. to get tickets and details and a list of speakers that include really the leading experts in the field, Jesse Marcel III, Jim Mars, Linda Moulton Howe, Richard Dolenz, Robert Salas, Stephen Bassett. Stephen Bassett's a UFO lobbyist in Washington, D.C. for ending the truth embargo. Of course, Travis Walton, Fire in the Sky, Nick Refren, William Brown, who was quite an interesting speaker last year about the galactic physics. David Wilcox, everybody knows him. Michael Tellinger will be there. Lynn Katai, who did a whole movie on the Phoenix Lights. I mean, everyone, James Gilliland and his lecture on the Anunnaki, a lot of very interesting people. And I look forward to meeting you too, Barbara.
Oh, please come. And come on out and take an evening and just hang out with us out at the Rock. You know, after a long day of all the presentations and all the workshops and everything, people just like to take the drive and come out to the desert and just sky watch and watch the skies and have a chance to sit by the energy of the Rock and just relax. So I hope to see you there, okay?
So the Rock for you is really the key place out there, isn't it? The giant Rock.
Yeah. Yeah, the big giant Rock. It's my passion, it's my love, and it's my research and my life. So
do you have a book about it? Do you have a book?
I'm working on it, and every time I've, like I said, every time I've gone to start writing, I have started it, and every time I go to think I've got it down pat right now, I can end it, there's another fabulous story that adds to it, and so I've got to learn to break it down into segments now, because it's just gotten too big and too long. I mean, I can get into, it starts with all the prehistoric history, then all the Native American history, and then I've got the old miner, the Frank Kreitzer, the guy who originally dug under the Rock and made the Rock his home, and then how he committed suicide and got blown to bits under the Rock. And then it goes
on. Why did he commit suicide, you think? Because he lived under the Rock. I mean, what was that about?
Oh, gosh, that is such another big, long story. We could be here for another hour.
Well, just a little bit, you really piqued my interest. What's a brief...
What was that?
Well, just a brief synopsis of why he would commit suicide because he lived out in Giant Rock.
Oh, well, he had a history. Well, everything that you're going to read about Frank Kreitzer, if you pulled his name up right now on the internet, it would tell you that he was a German spy, that he came from Germany, that he came to Giant Rock to live there because he had a lung disease from being in the Merchant Marines and all this history. However, up until 5 years ago, from research that I put together and I've learned through contact with his family, that, first of all, he wasn't German. He was actually born here in the States, and he became friends with George Van Tassel, and through his friendship with George Van Tassel, he picked up and he moved out to... He found his way to Giant Rock to do prospecting and mining, and he dug a big hole under the rock where he made a 400-square-foot house for himself. But he was still under investigation. He had the government at that time, get this, the Customs Department of the U.S. government was interested in what he was doing out here because he had made an airport. He was responsible for building Giant Rock Airport. However, it was never registered with the government, all these mysteries. And the government always had him under investigation, and there was a big, long story. And you will also read in many of the readings that there were three sheriffs from the local town, local area, that came out there to investigate him. And they threw dynamite under there, and it blew him to bits. However, that's not true. that's not true. What actually did happen, because from his death certificate and the police reports will say that, and it's confirmed that he actually committed suicide because he did not want to go in to register for the draft. Would you believe this or not? Because in 1942, the U.S. government instilled what is known as the fourth draft, where men between the ages of, I think 45 and 60 had to register for the draft. People don't know about this. It was called the old man's draft. And so these sheriffs from the local area went out there. Now, this is really out in the desert, and it would have taken Frank like a day or two to go to the local town to register for this draft. And they were coming out there to offer to take him into town to register. However, Frank was rather smart, and he knew what was up. He knew that the government, because he had been under investigation, because there were some things that were going on at the airport that were not on the up and up, but he didn't want to go. And these sheriffs, and however the government perceived it, kind of felt that if they could get him away from the Rock, somebody can come into the Rock area and see what was going on there. However, Frank had his own eccentric ways. He did not want to do certain things. And basically, when the sheriff showed up to offer to take him to Bannack, he said that he wasn't going to go and they're not going to take him alive. And he ignited these pair of binoculars that were around his neck, and he blew himself up under the Rock. And that's a quick story of it. And the interesting thing about all this is none of this, all of it has been, I have documentation to prove the newer story of what really happened, because most of the stuff, I should say all the stuff on the Internet is not true right now. And I've been wanting to rewrite the history for the family and rewrite some of it to change Frank's perspective. Here's a big interesting thing, because when you read about Frank Kreitzer, you'll read that he was a hermit, that he didn't want to have involvement with anybody. He just went out to the Rock to be alone and just leave him alone. However, my interest here is Frank Kreitzer was responsible for building 60 miles of roads that led to Giant Rock, and he was responsible for building Giant Rock Airport. So my question to people was that if you did not want people coming to you and you wanted to be a hermit, why would you build roads leading to your house, and why would you build an airport? And if you really did research and you looked into it, you would find out that Frank had a real liking for travel magazines and travel parts of newspapers, because he had big events out there where he would have, you know, PTA meetings where 400 PTA people would show up for picnics, Easter sunrise services, big things that happened out there. So the history and the things that have been written about him so far up until now cannot be true, but yet some of it is true. So it's weeded in with history. And the interesting thing for me as a historian is today, because of all of our cell material that we have, and we can document history as it happens on the spot, so there's no question about how history unfolds. However, back then, and how history was prior recorded, it's only been recorded by word of mouth. And as we all know, when you record history by word of mouth, it becomes exaggerated and not documented very well. So who knows how it really went down? And all you can do is follow
a
paper trail.
Well, it sounds suspicious. It sounds like there was more going on. I mean, how do you just make an airport. I mean, it sounds like there's some other government or secret government involvement. You just don't go out there and make an airport on your own. I mean, it's something strange. It's an interesting story, though. Thank you.
Yeah, and it even goes deeper and farther because it has connections to the Japanese Manzanar encampment trap, the camps that are just up the road here. It has a lot of connections, and that's just his story. And after his story, then comes the George Van Tassel story. So making a book and following that all through to answer your original question gets really interesting. And then after the George Van Tassel story, then you follow into the rock and how it's split and where it is and now in the present day. So it's so fascinating, and it never stops for me.
It's going to be a great book. Well, thank you for spending so much time going into detail, and I look forward to seeing you out at Joshua Tree, okay?
Oh, please do, and I hope everybody shows up and comes to the conference to Contact in the Desert at conference, you know, go visit the website and get details and come see me, okay?
Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Say hello to Victoria for me, okay?
I will, okay? Thank you.
I'll see you in a few weeks, like soon.
Thank you. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you. I've been talking to Barbara Harris, who's one of the keynote speakers at the upcoming Contact in the Desert Conference, Joshua Tree, California, at the Joshua Tree Retreat Center, August 8th to the 11th this year, 2014. For tickets, go to contactinthedesert.com. You can also go to my website, newrealities.com. And if you want to enter a ticket-winning contest, you can go to the website there, contactinthedesert.com/newrealities and fill out a ticket, or just buy a ticket now. I think there's still a slight discount on tickets before the final price at the door. Thank you for listening. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. Of course, you can go to my website, newrealities.com, and I'll be emceeing and hosting that conference out there in Contact in the Desert with George Norrie, you know, who's really on the forefront of this kind of program, this kind of radio program. George is really the king of the hill there, so it'll be a chance to meet and greet George and a bunch of other people, Eric Von Doniken. So look forward to seeing everyone out there. Thanks for listening, and if you want to reach me, my email is A@newrealities.com, and good night.